Welcome to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. It's good to get together again to provide facts to our community through Zoom technology and word of mouth. Thank you for listening. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your host for the hour, with engineer Mike Murphy and my Milford Township neighbor, Mike Metz. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Pat.
What's new on your prairie, wind prairie these days?
Well, I'll tell you, the colors are really starting to show up. There are a lot of different things in bloom. This is a great time of season for that. And there's lots of little ground nesting birds you're starting to see young pop up. And my kestrels are just about ready to fledge out of the box.
And I found a nest of cardinals yesterday with 5 eggs. And I sure enjoy your compass plants, the silphiums.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mike and listeners, we've got a lot in store for this first Friday in July, so let's get started. The weather will be hot again today with a high of 85. Nighttime temperatures approaching nirvana in the 65-degree range, so once you've been informed and entertained by KHOY-FM during the day, sleep well at night. Unless you're a night owl, then let the KHOY vibes entertain you all night long. There will be nothing but more sunshine with highs in the upper 80s and 90s throughout the weekend and into next week, possible thunderstorm on Tuesday. Let's welcome Dennis Hart, who works so wonderfully at gathering the news for this week in our very own local paper.
There was plenty of news in the Ames Tribune this past week. Let's start with last Friday, when the Trib reported that an Ames police officer who had allegedly driven on the wrong side of a highway at high speeds while he was intoxicated had been fired. Jason Eaton's employment ended when the PD decided he had violated department policy. Eaton faces a felony charge of eluding a law enforcement vehicle and a misdemeanor charge of operating while intoxicated. Authorities said Eaton was driving as fast as 131 miles an hour while an Iowa patrol officer chased him on Interstate 35. Eaton allegedly admitted to drinking 1 to 2 beers that night in March, and a state patrol officer discovered multiple opened and unopened alcohol containers inside his vehicle. The Trib also reported that the Ames School District would have a new teaching and learning director. Aaron Miller will succeed Christy Mixdorf in the position. Mixdorf will become an elementary principal in the North Polk Community School District. Miller took over as the director of teaching and learning in Ames yesterday. That's the same day that interim district superintendent Paula Vincent started. Miller has been an associate principal at the Ames Middle School. The Trib also reported that a years-long investigation by the Iowa Attorney General's office had reviewed nearly 50 complaints of sexual abuse against current and former Catholic priests and other officials. All of the allegations against Catholic priests fall outside Iowa's statute of limitations for criminal prosecution. There was also word that Iowa would spend millions of federal dollars to provide extra support to child care providers. The state will expand programs that provide salary supplements to early childhood workers and is increasing the rate that daycare providers can receive if they accept a federal child care assistance program for low-income families. And there was a story about 2 Ames-based people who were among 8 Iowans being recognized last weekend as emerging Iowa artists during the Des Moines Arts Festival. Saturday's paper reported on the train derailment that had taken place in Ames on Thursday afternoon. 27 cars of a Union Pacific train derailed near Dayton Avenue. No one was injured, but one of those cars was found to be leaking propane. Downtown traffic was rerouted for several hours because railroad crossings at Duff, Kellogg, Clark, and Hazel Avenues were blocked by the train. There was also word that a water main had broken on Kellogg Avenue in downtown Ames on Thursday. The city said residents in the area might experience low water pressure or see rusty-colored water, which they said was safe to drink and to cook with. The Trib also reported that the city of Ames had chosen its next police chief. Jeff Huff started serving as the new chief yesterday. He is a 26-year veteran of the police department and has served as interim chief for the past 10 months. City Manager Steve Shanker said Huff possesses what he called the right combination of experience and skills required of this critical leadership position. Huff said he intends to hire a diverse workforce. There was more last Saturday, including word that the Iowa Economic Development Authority had voted to approve $10 million in tax rebates to fund construction of a new indoor municipal swimming pool in Ames. That's about half of what the city had asked for, and that means the rest of the money for the proposed $22 to $27 million project will have to come from other sources. The Ames Chamber of Commerce plans to raise some of that money, and the city council may be asked to approve a bond referendum for Ames residents to vote on. The council will hear about possible funding options at its July 13th meeting. The current municipal pool at Ames High will be torn down next year. And the Trib reported on a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, which showed that former President Trump remains a polarizing figure in Iowa. 49% of state residents said they have a favorable view of the former president, and 49% say they have an unfavorable view. Sunday's Trib reported on the reaction in Boone to word that notes had been found on front doors, saying, "Burn that gay flag." A Boone man had been arrested and charged with trespassing with a hate crime enhancement in connection with that incident. A Boone city councilman read a resolution at the council meeting a week ago saying the city stands in solidarity with its LGBTQ population and condemns any threats, harassment, intimidation, and violence against them. That resolution will appear on the council's agenda this coming Monday. There was also a report about the recent visit to Nevada from former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. Her visit prompted some speculation that she could be a candidate for president in 2024. But Haley said she will not run if former President Trump seeks another term. In Nevada, she said she was disappointed in Trump's actions after the election, and she called China the top threat to national security. And there was word that Iowa State University researchers are hoping that a comic book will help make the science of mosquitoes, yes, mosquitoes, accessible to everyone, and perhaps inspire a new generation to study the insect's role in disease and ecology. The comic book is titled Mosquitoes Suck, and its author says science comics can help young listeners retain more information and can help bridge the gap between students' thoughts on science as something removed from their daily lives and something they can be part of. Tuesday's paper reported that Iowa State University police had found a suspicious package outside a building at the Frederickson Court Apartments on Monday. That package was inspected and found not to be a threat. Officers had evacuated surrounding buildings and relocated staff and students to the Frederickson Court Community Center. People on campus were told to avoid the area. The Trib also reported that one person had been killed and another injured in a two-vehicle crash in Boone County on Sunday morning. The fatal victim was identified as 22-year-old Alexander John Ziegler of Boone. The crash took place at the intersection of 210th Street and R Avenue. Authorities said Ziegler was traveling eastbound when another vehicle heading south allegedly failed to stop at a stop sign and struck Ziegler's vehicle. Authorities said Ziegler died on the scene and was not wearing a seatbelt. The driver of the other vehicle was injured and taken to the Boone County Hospital. The Trib also reported that even though it's been a dry year so far, it's not time to put away the bug spray. The reason? The drought can mean fewer of the mosquitoes that are most likely to draw blood from people, but it could also mean a higher intensity of West Nile virus among the remaining mosquito population. There was also word that a new Japanese restaurant in campus town in Ames had opened for business. Its name is Ichiban, and it's at 117 Welsh Avenue. It's owned by Guan Wang, and this is his first restaurant. He said his real job is coaching professional ice hockey, but the coronavirus pandemic changed his plans. And just in time for the 4th of July, the Trib had word on the holiday celebrations that will take place in this area. The city of Ames will host a fireworks display at Jack Trice Stadium tomorrow night at dusk. The city's 4th of July parade will take place in downtown on Sunday morning at 11. In Slater, there will be a 5K run tomorrow morning at 6:15, followed by a pancake breakfast at 8 and a parade at 10. Then tomorrow, there will be a beer garden and carnival and a performance by the community band and chorus. Fireworks will take place tomorrow night. And still in Slater, on the 4th itself, there will be a carnival and food and crafts fair starting at 11 in the morning. In Nevada, there will be a parade on the 4th starting at 11 a.m. In Boone, the annual Eve of Destruction will take place July 4th at the Boone Speedway. And in Roland, the city will have its parade tomorrow morning starting at 10. Then there will be fireworks at dusk. This part of Roland's 150-plus-1 celebration on Saturday, a celebration that includes food, water activities, a school reunion, music, and historical events. Wednesday's Trib reported that since the coronavirus had come to Iowa, nearly every nursing home in the state had been affected by it. Fewer than 10% of Iowa's 431 nursing homes had reported no confirmed cases of the virus. The Trib also reported that a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll showed that more than half of Iowans oppose a change in state law that bans the teaching of certain concepts, including that the U.S. or the state are fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist. And there was word that a University of Northern Iowa professor and her students are working to save wood turtles in the state. Those turtles are among the 116 species of wildlife that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources lists as being endangered, threatened, or of special concern. Yesterday's Trib reported that 9 more cases of the coronavirus had been confirmed in Story County. That brought the total number of cases in the county to 10,728 since the pandemic started. The county's 14-day positivity rate was 1.6%. It was also word the Roland Story School District had approved a plan to spend more than $638,000 in federal coronavirus relief money. The district plans to use it to fund 3 years of summer school, 2 special education teachers, and new weight room and vocal music equipment. The plan still needs approval from the state of Iowa. Also yesterday, word that 2/3 of Iowans oppose a new law that went into effect yesterday, letting adults buy and carry handguns without a permit. Democrats and gun violence prevention groups say they're concerned the new law rolls back background checks on handgun sales between private citizens. And the Trib reported on a Dallas County woman who had invented a garden product to help keep critters from eating plants. Patricia Tice calls her creation the Plant Patron. It's a protective cover of sorts that keeps animals like raccoons, deer, and rabbits off new and existing plants. And that is your summary of the week's news from the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, reporting today from Washington, D.C., and already planning to be back in this same virtual seat on Monday morning at 7 on Local Talk, when I'll have word on what's been making news around the state. Between now and then, I hope we both have a great weekend and a great 4th of July.
Traveling, looking for something. What can it be? Oh, I hate you some. I hate you some. I love you some. Oh, I love you when I forget about me. I wanna be strong. I wanna live alone. I wanna belong to the living. Alive, alive. I wanna get up and drive. Wanna wreck my stockings in some jukebox.
Thank you, Dennis Hart, with your Week in the News. And the music interlude was All I Want by Joni Mitchell from her album Blue, released 50 years ago. Traveling, traveling, Mike. And so turtles have been on my mind recently. And here to tell us about wood turtles in East Central Iowa is a researcher from the University of Northern Iowa, Dr. Jeff Tamplin. Welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you for having me on.
Been enchanted by some of your wood turtle research. Could you please describe for our listeners a wood turtle?
Sure. A wood turtle is considered a medium-sized turtle. So as an adult, they get to be 8 to 10 inches or so in shell length. It's nowhere near as big as a very large snapping turtle or a large soft-shell turtle, but certainly much bigger than, say, a box turtle that some people are familiar with. They're named a wood turtle because of two reasons. One is their shell looks a little bit like sculptured or carved wood. So the genus and species name, the scientific name of the species is Glyptemes insculpta. And when you translate that from the Latin, it means the sculptured carved turtle. So partially that's because their shell resembles a little bit like carved wood. But this is a kind of an unusual turtle species because many turtle species have a particular habitat that they reside in, and it might be a particular pond, or it might be a riverine turtle, or maybe it's a sandy prairie turtle like an ornate box turtle. This particular species changes its habitat preferences seasonally. So they hibernate in the rivers, then in the spring and the falls, they sleep in the river at night, but then they are around the riverbank area. The biological term for that is a riparian area. But then in the summer, when it gets warm, they go way away from the river. They can go 200, 300 or so meters into the forested floodplain. So they're oftentimes in the summer found in the woods, and the fact that their shell looks a little bit like sculptured wood is where their common name comes from.
And they are a beautiful turtle. That sculptured wood effect is very striking.
Your research is centered in Black Hawk and Butler County along the Cedar River. Is that correct?
I work in a couple of field sites, and we actually try our best not to tell people exactly where these turtles are located. That it's not as much of a problem in Iowa because there's so few wood turtles, but on the East Coast, where they're a little bit more abundant, poaching is a huge problem. And there's a pretty large black market trade in the species because they're very intelligent, particularly for a turtle. And once you get to know wood turtles, most people fall in love with them. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of amateur herpetologists that, of course, like to raise these things. And many of them, I think, have good intentions. But there's a bustling illegal trade in this species. And so we try not to tell people exactly where you can find them. But, you know, I work on some field sites along the Cedar River and along the West Fork of the Cedar River. I also work in there's several Beaver Creeks in Iowa, but I work in a watershed of the Beaver Creek as it enters the Cedar. This species actually inhabits what we call the Turkeyfoot region. So it's the North Cedar River, where the headwaters start in Minnesota, and then cross the Iowa border, and then the Shell Rock River, and then the West Fork of the Cedar, that all basically join together and become the Cedar River proper. And that happens right just north of Cedar Falls, just north of the Cedar Falls city limits.
And you mentioned the black market trade. Yes, that's a grave concern to a lot of the turtle people, turtle researchers primarily here in Iowa. Are wood turtles in danger? What is their federal status currently?
So right now there's a petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to consider them for federal endangered status. And that petition is, I think it was perhaps maybe formally initiated in 2015, and they're due to make a decision on that here in the next couple of years. So part of the reason why federal government has been funding us in some neighboring states, Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan also, is to get more data on this species across its range. They've been state listed as endangered in Iowa since 1997. And so one of the things is, before they're designated as federally endangered, the government would like to have data from across the range and try to assess the population status. Are they truly on the decline in every single state that they occupy? Are there some populations that are still sort of vigorous and strong and healthy? The Iowa population is what's called a peripheral isolate. So this species here in Iowa is not contiguous with any of the other wood turtle populations that occur, say, in Minnesota or Wisconsin. And if you would have asked me, or probably really any other wood turtle researcher, say 20 years ago, we would have said, oh, well, if the Iowa population is isolated, both physically and genetically, from other wood turtles in the Midwest, it's probably because of habitat fragmentation and land usage changes. And in the past, you know, 100 or 200 years at most, but in the past 100 or so years, as we've converted our land to agriculture and we've built roads, what we're basically doing is chopping up the habitat and then isolating these particular creatures. So, but when we did a genetic analysis of the Iowa population, what we were surprised to discover was that Iowa wood turtles are as genetically distinct from the Minnesota population that we sampled, which was up around Minneapolis, as the Iowa population was from wood turtles on the East Coast in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. So what that tells us really is, the best explanation for that is that, you know, during the prior glacial periods, when these areas of Iowa that wood turtles inhabit, which is still just a small little spot here, but when those areas were covered with glaciers, the glacial refugia is the term that you use, but the glacial refugia for this species was in northern Georgia and southern Tennessee and in northern Mississippi. And then as the last glacier retreated, all kinds of animals, including this one, had to basically recolonize this area. So as the glaciers retreated, this species is moving north again, and it's kind of inhabiting sort of the same climate zone as what we would experience today in this particular area. It's just that climate zone is moving as the glaciers are, you know, expanding and then eventually retreating. One of the things that was unusual for us was that, you know, this species population in Iowa doesn't appear to be just isolated physically from the Minnesota one. It's also isolated genetically. And it most likely is here because a group of wood turtles migrated to this area from their glacial refugia in the south, separate from the groups of wood turtles that then colonized Minnesota and Wisconsin. And you see that in the way they look, and you see that a little bit in their behavior. So it's a, you know, we use the term in biology, conservation unit. So, you know, we haven't described this Iowa population as a new species or a separate species from the other wood turtles, or even as a subspecies, but basically it's its own unique genetic unit. It has its own unique alleles, which are gene variants. It has things called private alleles that only this population has. And that makes it actually very valuable for conservation, because you, one of the common sense things is you think, oh, well, if we have an endangered species and we're trying to conserve this species and maintain their population base or even augment it, you think, well, let's go to somewhere where the individuals are still somewhat abundant and that there's lots of juveniles there, and find places in the range where the population still appears healthy, and we'll preserve those populations because they have the best chance of surviving. But really, it's actually these weird populations that live on the periphery of the species range that are most valuable biologically because they have those different private alleles and those different unique gene variants and stuff. And one of the reasons for that is because, you know, there's a reason why this population of wood turtles in Iowa essentially doesn't go any farther south or west than these field sites that I'm working at. So something about, you know, the number of frost days or the average monthly temperature, say in July, or the average monthly temperature in December and January, there's something about the physical parameters of this area that allow the species to persist here, but not to expand its range. So it's really these weird isolated populations that are the most important to conserve, not so much the healthier ones, quote unquote, you know, in the middle of their range.
Sure. Oh, this is fascinating. I guess it's probably a good point to discuss then the fact that a certain percentage of our Iowa wildlife species, of which there's over 1,000, I think I read where there's 1,104 different species in Iowa, and 10.5% of those are endangered, threatened, or species of special concern. So what can you share with our listeners about what can be done to ensure that we have wood turtles into the future?
Well, particularly for wood turtles, they're experiencing a couple of pressures on their population. And one is that we call this population a ghost population. Mostly that's related to the fact that it's a bunch of older adults that are at the end of their lifespan. And despite the fact that they, you know, typically mate every year, they actually mate twice a year in the fall and the spring. And then, you know, when they're carrying eggs, the term for that is gravid. So despite the fact that our gravidity rates are fairly reasonable, this year was somewhat low, but a lot of times it's 75-80% of the females that are mature adults are gravid and carrying eggs, and they lay those eggs. The problem is that many times those eggs don't hatch, and it's kind of a two-headed monster. One is that raccoon abundance is very high, and because raccoons are urban adapters, they're one species of animal that does better in human-disturbed habitats. So, you know, like squirrels and rats and mice and, you know, and pigeons, many other species, they do better in places that humans have changed the habitat and altered it. And so because raccoons are good at being urban adapters, our crops are food for them, our sewer systems are tunnels and breeding areas for them. So basically raccoons are not only predators of the adult turtles, this species of turtle doesn't have a hinged bottom shell, so they can't close up and protect themselves like, say, a box turtle can, or even a Blanding's turtle has, you know, can do that to a degree. So this turtle, basically, their protection from, say, a narrow-snouted mammal, like a raccoon or a skunk, is to pull their head in their shell and then put their arms up there and try to wedge their arms in there and protect their head. So raccoons tend to be able to get their snout in there, and they chew the arms, the limbs off of this species, and they typically, it's almost unbelievable, but they typically survive that. So about 20% of the ones I've encountered here are missing at least one arm or leg. I've encountered a few that are missing two. And they seem to be able to clot their blood and not, you know, not bleed out when they've essentially had their arm chewed off. But they also, raccoons can get in there and eventually get to the head. And when they chew their head off, obviously they don't survive that. So it's raccoon abundance that is not only killing these older adults sort of one by one, but raccoons are notorious for digging up the eggs. So in a place like Iowa, turtles are synchronized as to when they lay their eggs. They typically lay their eggs late May, early June, usually the first couple of weeks of June. That gives a couple of months for the embryos to incubate and then hatch and still have a month or two to feed before that first winter's hibernation. So it's raccoons picking off the adults one by one. It's raccoons being very efficient at digging up the eggs of not only wood turtles, but just about any species of turtle. And then our other problem is that flooding patterns have changed here dramatically. So when we go back and say, look at river gauge data on Iowa rivers that wood turtles inhabit, we see that there was a major change. And it used to be that rivers flooded here after the spring snow melt and the thaw. And then we got maybe rains in April, and the rivers would flood for, you know, weeks or a month or something. And then the floods would subside. And the rest of the summer, typically those rivers didn't flood again. So what's been happening for the past 20, 30, 40 years, and if you guys have lived in Iowa for, you know, any long amount of time, you've seen that we have floods along our river systems here all year round. We have floods in December sometimes on the Cedar River. We have floods, you know, seems like almost every June. And this particular species of turtle, their eggs can only survive being submerged by water for 24 hours. So what happens is wood turtles and other species lay their eggs usually close to the water line along the river in an area that's, you know, sort of out of the low water area, but certainly within the river banks. And so at some point during the summer, if that river even floods for 2 or 3 days and submerges these beaches and stuff that turtles lay their eggs on, then their embryos don't hatch. And when that happens, you know, 18 out of 20 years or 25 years out of 26 years, then you get whole generations of turtles that are missing. So you don't have the juvenile age classes there. And basically these adults aren't replacing themselves. And as they're getting older and older and older, and most of these are 35, 40, 50 years old at the end of their lifespan, then there's no younger replacements for them.
So hence the term a ghost.
Right. Population. So there's still some adults out there. They're hard to find. And, you know, I've been doing this for about 20 years here, and I documented 47 deaths out of the 138 turtles that I've marked. Certainly some of those turtles, you know, are also, you know, some of the other ones are likely dead because I'm using radio transmitters to follow around some of them. I think I've tracked a total of maybe 56 at this point or so. But you know, so most of the turtles I've encountered, I've made some markings that allow me to recognize their shell, but then you'll never see those turtles ever again unless you're radio tracking them. So our mortality rates here are basically unsustainable. One of the studies we did a couple of years ago that we jointly published with data from Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, indicates that for this species to persist, the adults need an annual survival rate of at least 95%. And at the field sites that I've been studying, our annual survival rates are in the 70s and 80%. And that might sound okay. Hey, 75% of the adults live, you know, through this year into the next year. But because this is a species that their success is predicated on living for 50 or 60 years and laying eggs maybe, you know, 3 years out of four and having a few of those juveniles turn to sexually mature adults, when you disrupt that, especially when you disrupt that system quickly, like over the period of 30 or 40 years, basically a generation of turtles, then they can't adapt to these rapid changes.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a tough row to hoe for wood turtles. Is there anything else that comes to mind that you would feel imperative to share with our listeners?
Well, I'd say, you know, that we discussed this with the DNR, and I think we're all sort of in agreement. I mean, we do things like restore habitat. And, you know, a lot of what the funding they've channeled towards me is to basically study their behavioral patterns. How much do they move? How large of an area does each individual occupy? That's called its home range. So what's the home range size? How does that change in populations that are either more or less disturbed by human development? How does that differ between, say, juveniles and adults? How does that differ between males and females? So what we're basically doing is trying to figure out the behavior of this species, because this species might be well studied, say, on the East Coast, but what they do in Iowa can be completely different because the habitat here is different because it's a different genetic population of turtles. So we're trying to learn what to do so that we can better restore the habitat and alter the habitat in ways that promote their survival. But probably the biggest thing we could do is to artificially incubate the egg. So basically, when we see females nesting, we've tried things like building nest predator exclusion cages and actually caging the nest and leaving them in place. And we have seen that not work very well, to be honest. You cage the nest and it floods. Well, those eggs are still destroyed anyway. You cage the nest and you do it well enough that raccoons can't get under it and it doesn't flood. Certainly, we've done that in years. And some of those years that they didn't flood, it's because it was a drought year. Like last year. So it didn't. I had three different nests, about 40 wood turtle eggs caged in three different places, and none of those flooded. And probably early September, when I realized it doesn't look like these eggs are hatching, we dug up the cages to get at them. And all of those eggs had either been invaded by plant roots or had desiccated, because it essentially in these sites, it didn't rain in July or August for 2 months. So the best thing we can do is, basically, with the permission of the DNR, is to dig up the eggs and very carefully transport them back to a laboratory and then incubate them and then release the hatchlings at the nest site. So at least that way you're giving them some chance. Some of those hatchlings will still be depredated by predators, but at least you're giving them, it's kind of called head starting, you're giving them a head start. When we do that, we employ this strategy, we release some right after they hatch. We keep some and then we feed them and try to maximize their growth for about a month or so. And then we release them in time before so they can acclimate to winter conditions coming up. And then we keep another set throughout that whole winter and feed them and keep them warm and don't let them hibernate, so that by the time we release them that following spring, they're really like the size of, say, a 3 or 4 year old turtle, even though they're only 9 months old.
Wonderful. May all your work efforts prove successful to a certain degree. I know they all can't make it, but sounds like you've got a strategy. And I understand you're going to be in the field tomorrow. I hope there's hatchling wood turtles in your future.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to wildlife researcher and professor at University of Northern Iowa, Dr. Jeffrey Tamplin, concerning wood turtles, a species endangered in Iowa. Dr. Tamplin emphasized wood turtles evolved successfully for 18 million years and are becoming increasingly endangered in the last 200 years since European settlement in Iowa. He wants you to know our wood turtle population has gene variants, and in nature that is a plus because we all evolved from the mutant genes in our population. And in case you're wondering, when researchers talk about radio telemetry, that is a term used by gluing transmitters or radios onto the turtle's shell so they can track their whereabouts. So let's take a music break with more local talk to come here at KHOI.
Wanna write you a love letter, wanna make you feel better, wanna make you feel.
And we're back. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I'm your host, Pat Schlarbaum, with Mike Metz and engineer Mike Murphy. Let's welcome Susan Guiasta, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us once again. Do you have any announcements for the city over the 4th of July weekend?
Well, sure. I'll continue to remind people that Independence Day fireworks are on Saturday, July 3rd. They start around dusk, which tends to be around 9:45-ish, and they will be shot off around Jack Drake Stadium. So that is on Saturday, July 3rd. The 4th of July parade is 11 a.m. on that Sunday, July 4th, and it is concentrated in the downtown area. The city will have several trucks and entries into the parade, so we're happy to see everybody. And we will also have a display of posters and yard signs in front of City Hall that have been decorated by area residents, really showcasing what they appreciate about Ames. We have over 100 yard signs. They're really fun. Some of them are probably up to interpretation, but they are things that kids love about Ames, the library, the aquatic center. There are things adults love about Ames, the parks and the green spaces, and they're just kind of fun. So we'll have those up for a while in front of City Hall, and people can come through and look at them.
Oh, great. Sounds like a great destination. 4th of July on Sunday. Whom did you invite to join us today?
Well, you may notice how dry it's been lately. It's been quite dry listening to the discussion on the turtles and the flooding. Doesn't seem like we've had much of that lately. Yeah. But we do get calls and emails occasionally asking about water conservation policies that we may or may not have in place. And so Neil's going to talk a little bit about water conservation and where we stand this year and what you can do to reduce your water bill.
Oh, great. Welcome, Neil Weiss, Assistant Water and Pollution Control Director here for the City of Ames. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you for having me on this morning. Yes, like Susan said, we are getting a number of different calls about water conservation, and with some of the surrounding cities putting in some mandatory water conservation, get a lot of calls here in Ames asking if anything's mandatory at the time being. And I just want to make it clear that it's still on a voluntary basis for water conservation, but we are watching the trends in the coming weeks to really monitor the drought that we're in. So we really want to monitor the river levels and the well levels is what we're really looking at. So Ames is fortunate to have well water versus surface water like many cities downstream from us. So that gives us the ability to pull water from the aquifer in actually four different well fields. We can spread out the pumping that we're doing at the water plant.
I was going to interject with our water sources are from wells rather than directly from the river or?
Correct. Yeah. Yep, so we pull water from the Ames aquifer. We're strictly groundwater source. So we have 22 wells over four different well fields that we pull water from. So like I said, it's spread out across the city, which is nice that we can do different well combinations so we're not pulling more water out of one portion of the aquifer than we need to. That's a real benefit in a drought time like this.
Are there any comparisons this summer to some of the other dry years? It seemed like 77 was kind of a benchmark in drought conditions. 88 kind of comes to mind. Are there comparisons? Or are you preparing for what might be a long, dry summer?
Yes, we certainly are comparing it, and that's a great point. That we look back and look at these historical trends to kind of predict what may happen in the future. Yeah. So we look at some recent events like 2012. We can really compare our well levels. We have all the data that we go back and look at to look at how high is that water level above each of the pump in our wells. We actually just have a color scale showing green, red, and yellow to really show the levels of these wells. So the point that we're at right now is nowhere near the drought that we saw in 2012. But like you said, we are preparing because we look at the weather forecast over the next 2 weeks. It doesn't look like we're unfortunately going to get much rain. And then, you know, I mentioned those river levels. That river really helps to recharge the aquifer. So we take a look at what kind of flows do we have upstream in Ames and compare that to some of the rain or the stream gauges we have downstream of Ames. So that can really tell us how much recharge are we getting. So that number is really important because when it starts dropping significantly, that's when we can tell that, all right, the water is not percolating into the aquifer, and we start looking at what to do here in the future.
Is Ada Hayden Reservoir fit into any of your water source schemes?
It does. So the Ada Hayden Reservoir is used as a backup water source. So what we would do if the rivers got down to a significantly low level where there was not much flow at all in the rivers, we would start looking at a pumping operation from Ada Hayden where we would pump into the river to actually help recharge the aquifer that way. So we're not anywhere near those levels right now, but that's certainly one of our contingency plans looking out long into the future. So that's always an option for us to consider.
Sure is, and it's a good option to always keep in mind of our water quality. That is a blessing here in Ames, and we sure hope the water quality there at Ada Hayden can always be maintained in these real high levels of quality. And
yes, that's a great point. And we are continuing to monitor the water quality at Ada Hayden. Every 3 to 5 years, we'll do a water quality study at Ada Hayden to make sure that we're achieving those results that we'd like to.
Did I read about some new water rates that were implemented first part of July?
Yes, July 1st, water rates went into effect. I believe it was a 6% increase in water rates for July 1st. So users will start seeing that on their bills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good point, too, to bring up for the summer and water use. We have a block structure where during the summer months, it's really focused on promoting that water conservation. And the outdoor water use is where we see the huge increase in water use during the summer. So continuing to use the same amount of water throughout the year can really help you save money here in Ames. If you get over that 1,000 cubic foot per month of water use, then that block structure starts to raise and the price of water per cubic foot will drastically raise.
Yeah, it's always good to conserve, don't we know? And particularly during these years of rain in the forecast, and then it's really not materializing. Not much water to work with in the atmosphere, apparently.
Yep, that's right. And we, you know, a lot of people like to water their yards and have a green grass. And
oh, yeah.
Really want to promote that. You know, if you are watering, only put an inch of water on your lawn per week is really what the Midwest grass needs. And also to make sure that you're doing that watering in the early morning hours, the 6 to 9 a.m., to really avoid that evaporation during the middle of the day. So those are two things we really want to promote during these summer months.
Avoid watering the sidewalks, your driveway, and the pavement in front of your house, because it goes without saying. But always good to keep those water conservation measures in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. With the new rates in effect, you know, you really might want to reconsider your watering plans. I walk every morning and I see some of the same homes that they're watering every single morning, and it really isn't necessary. I think Neil has talked about a way to measure by putting a cup out and determining when you've hit that inch, you're done for the week, and then you don't need to continue watering. And again, we always promote, I know I've talked about my rain barrels on your show before, and just I'm amazing how much one good rainfall can fill that rain barrel. And you can use that water strategically all week. Now with a 6% increase in water rates, you'll want to look for ways to decrease your water consumption to keep your bill the same.
Yeah,
that's a good point, Susan.
Yeah, wonderful point. A rain barrel or a water barrel, you know, in some states in the West, they're illegal. So take advantage of what Mother Nature provides us here in Iowa with a rain barrel or a water barrel.
Yes, like Susan said, that rain barrel is a great idea. And through our smart water program, we do offer rebates too for those rain barrels.
Yeah.
So if that's an option you're looking into, please contact our department and we can get you hooked up with the rebate form for that.
Okay. What's your number there to contact?
The water plant number is 515-239-5150. And I encourage everyone to follow us on all social media platforms too at Ames Water. We continuously post different water conservation tips, so please go check us out on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Great, and thank you for all your clean water efforts, Mr. Neil Weiss. Anything else?
No, I appreciate you having me on, and like you said, water conservation is real important, especially this time of year during a drought. So everyone just does their part and tries to help with this outdoor water conservation. It'll really help us out on as far as our pumping levels.
Great. Have a safe and enjoyable 4th of July weekend. Neil Weiss, Assistant Water and Pollution Control Director with the City of Ames, and Susan Guiasta, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have another guest that has joined us, Amber Wangert with ISU Extension. Hello, hello. We replay this broadcast at 5 p.m., so I'll be editing that, but it is nice to welcome you. And we're kicking off a new segment. You're going to try to join us the first and third Fridays of each month. This is great. And you're with ISU Extension. So tell us a little bit about ISU Extension, if you could, just to get started.
Well, I'm with Story County Extension, and Iowa State Extension and Outreach provides research-based education to the public. So we provide you tips for, you know, nutrition, weed, plants. We have youth program outreach. Extension does hold the 4-H program for the youth as well. So we have a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Programs and for all ages and stages of life, as we like to say.
And how many years has ISU Extension been in existence? Do you know the history of that?
I believe it was like 1918 was when it was founded. So, yes.
So you were the main outreach when Iowa State was a college to the public that was providing funding for this college. And it was ISU Extension that was kind of critical in providing the knowledge of what they were studying here at Iowa State College. Are you from Ames?
No, I grew up in Central Iowa, so I'm from the Midwest here, so very familiar with Ames.
Sure.
I graduated from Iowa State with a marketing degree, so...
Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. So was it a part of an internship, or how did your career get such a strong foothold to get employment right here at Iowa State University?
Well, my official job title is a marketing and office coordinator. So I do all the promoting for our programs. I take care of our social media outlets, our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and then I also, you know, answer the phones when people call in, take your questions, and can refer you to the proper resource specialist to handle that. I'm kind of the liaison of the office, so to speak.
Yeah. So you're the modern outreach, I guess, utilizing all the modern outlet opportunities.
I've got a question for you, Amber. This is Mike Metz. I was wondering... Some of the, we discussed some of the programs, about a month or so ago. What's happening these days with the youth? What kind of programs do you offer these days?
Well, coming up here in July, we have a Native Bee program for the youth, July 8th. We still have some spots available. It's for recommended for grades through 4th through 8th. Kids come and learn about what bees we have are native to Iowa, where they live, and why they're important to our pollination process.
And about those bees, these would be different than the honeybee that was imported from Europe, right?
Right, yep. The ones that are native here in Iowa, exactly.
Great.
And that includes bumblebees also. People kind of unaware of that, the value that bumblebees provide our Iowa landscape. So when you started this, you know, I'm sure you had a job description and you know, some they had a certain individual in mind that you qualified to be hired. But have you been able to set any goals for you? Are there things that you would like to accomplish in your career here with ISU Extension?
Some of the goals that I am looking to just be able to put myself out there a little bit more, do some more Facebook Lives and do some live interaction with the public. That seems to be a trend. We started a TikTok as well, one of the new social media outlets that I am not as familiar with. So kind of just trying to keep up with the times is my goal. Keep up with the youth and keep up with all those trending things that are happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned TikTok. I think I've heard of that.
Yes.
How is that connected to Facebook? Or maybe there's other listeners that maybe have heard about it and still kind of, like me, a little bit sketchy on what exactly, what TikTok offers that other venues do not.
Mm-hmm. TikTok is, it's a separate social media platform, and it's basically all videos.
Oh.
Mostly you post a video about yourself or how we do it, post a video about a program and try to make it cute and entertaining to grab audience attention. And then we do share it on our Facebook page as well, which is ISU Extension Story. If you want to like us on Facebook, you can see our TikTok videos there as well.
Oh, fantastic. So, and I've heard about Snapchat. So I guess that's more... More just images as opposed
more
to videos.
Pictures, yes.
Well, the
yes.
things you learn on Local Talk. This is this is great. We have a few more minutes. If are there things that, that you're going to welcome contributing to KHOI? Or how we might be mutually beneficial to each other?
Yes. I mean, I'm here. I can tell you all about some more of our upcoming programs for the community and... I am a little bit of know it all about all of our programs that we offer, I guess, in the office. So if you don't mind, I can tell you a little bit about a couple more things happening in July.
Oh, please do. Sure.
Okay. So July 15th, I'll kind of start with our youth programming. We have Water Connects Us All program, grades 3 through 6. Youth can come learn kind of what a watershed is and the important roles of a wetland. And the fun activities, they get to build some models and explore our rural and urban water quality practices. There's plenty of space available for that, as well as we have some a mosquitoes and me program. Now you think mosquitoes, maybe yuck. No one likes mosquitoes, right?
Oh, I've heard about this. Mosquitoes suck. Yeah.
Yes, they do. Our youth coordinator, Mary, she's actually growing mosquitoes here in our office. So she's been growing them in these little containers in our office. But we held that program in June, and the kids really loved it. I mean, just because it's about mosquitoes doesn't mean they're not going to have fun. They get to break out the microscopes and really delve in and learn about all things mosquito-related. So that's July 29th, and that's for grades 3 through 6.
And let's mention the website now and then probably sure. repeat it later. But where would they go to learn more about mosquitoes and your programs?
They can visit us at extension.iastate.edu/story. Or our phone number at our office, too. You can call us at 515-337-1601.
Okay. Is there anything else that maybe that you got planned for August later in the summer?
We do have some adult programming in August that we have one on August 3rd that's free to the public. It's here at our extension office in Ames, and it's called Preserve the Taste of Summer with our nutrition specialist, Holly. And it's come and learn how to preserve your garden produce with canning or freezing, get some tips. And she'll get you started there. So,
okay. Well, Amber, I really want to express our appreciation for your marketing outreach and and including KHOI as a part of your voice to the community. And maybe just one more little tidbit. I'm really curious about what you bring to the Ames community and the ISU community at large. Anything about yourself that maybe a little tidbit about yourself that may surprise people or your friends that comes to mind?
Maybe the surprise of the community is I just started with Extension about 8 months ago, and this is actually my first official marketing role since I graduated. So that might be a little bit of a surprise for y'all.
Yeah, I think you're a natural at this.
I think you got this well in hand.
I think that was good to come up with. I kind of put you on the spot, so you're good.
Yes.
you're good in the spotlight. Mike Metz.
Yeah, that's great that we're beneficial to have that announcement. You've heard it here first, folks. So thanks and good luck, and we look forward to visiting with you every other week.
Yes, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's great. And thank you, Amber Wengert with ISU Extension. We hope to see you again real soon. Thanks a lot.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Friday at 89.1 FM. And tell your friends far and wide KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org. And please remember to support this station financially when you go to the website khoifm.org. You can find the yellow donate button there. Click it and follow the prompts. KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is a community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media.
Thank you, Local Talk producers Ursula Rudenberg and Lynn Carey, and thank you, Dennis Hart, for your Friday report. Thank you, engineer Mike Murphy and co-host Mike Metz. And thanks to our guests, Dr. Jeff Tamplin with the University of Northern Iowa, Susan Guiazda and Neil Weiss with the City of Ames, and Amber Wengert with ISU Extension. This is Pat Schlarbaum.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other artists you heard were Joni Mitchell, All I Want. Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.